Welcome back to Conversations with Nova Reed. It is a pleasure to keep you company with me for the next hour and a quarter or so. And I really loved recording this episode, and I hope you enjoy it. I love it as much as I do. I wanted to invite one of my anti-racism students, and I say students. She's not a student anymore. She graduated quite some time ago. But she's somebody who is really embodying the work and showing up for human beings in a way that is really powerful and quite healing. And we're all students. Like, anti-racism work is never done. In becoming anti-racist is a journey, and we are always in a state of becoming. But the more work we do on ourselves, the more knowledge we obtain, the more time we dedicate, the more we are committed, the more our world and our minds and our eyes are open, the more powerful our allyship becomes, and the more able we are to show up in the world with intention and meaning. And I wanted to be able to talk about what it means to embody anti-racism with Amanda. It sounds a bit abstract here, but we really do talk about what that sounds like, feels like, and looks like, certainly in her experience. It's not going to be the same for everybody, but the difference between embodying it, becoming the work, and just getting it intellectually. We also cover a lot of ground. We talk about everything from the relationship between white women and black women, embodying anti-racism. And we also talk about some of the challenges along the way and some of the biggest learning moments. So I hope you enjoy it. And if you are somebody who is interested or curious about becoming anti-racist, then my online course, which is what Amanda graduated from, or an earlier version of, is available to you now, Becoming Anti-Racist. And if you want to find out more about what that journey involves and how that can support you in your anti-racism journey, then click on the link in your show notes to find out more. But without further ado, I'm going to let you tune into the episode, and I really hope you love it as much as I do.
Understanding where people are coming from and seeing people as humans they are, who make mistakes, has helped me for myself. And I feel like creativity and joyfulness are really at the heart of who I feel like I am. Mm. I find joy in little things, and I feel like that's one of the reasons I'm so attracted to your work as well. And the joy you find in stuff, I think that's really important.
Thank you. Beautiful answer. Thank you for playing along. So when did you start? Can you pinpoint when you realized you needed to do anti-racism work?
I feel like this has come in stages, probably. I feel like my husband is Ghanaian. He was born in Ghana and he came here when he was little. I grew up in a church where I was surrounded by people of all different races. But I first really, when I went into a relationship with him, I feel like I'd been around this idea and I was accepting that there were differences and there were things, right? So we weren't taught a colorblind approach almost. My mum was, I told us, you know, about looking for differences and seeing similarities and all these different things. Oh my goodness, I'm cringing now. I know when we first got together, I definitely felt, I saw racism, I saw the bigger things, the more overt things, and I gradually learned probably the smaller things. I can remember, this is so embarrassing, am I going to share this? Yeah. I must have been about 18, 19, and disagreeing with Michael that I was like, yeah, but but racism can happen to white people, of course. And he's trying to explain to me, like, oh, well, it's power and oppression and, like, how it's all interlinked. And I was like, well, the Oxford Dictionary definition says.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, because who created the dictionary? I'm like, oh, okay. And he's very, he's very patient. It didn't shame me for my ridiculousness. He was like, one day you'll realize, and you'll feel a bit silly, but it'll be okay. Mm. And he was right. And, you know, so I feel like that was my first kind of introduction into like, oh, hold on a second, this is like, you know, way, way deeper. So we would have chats, and I feel like then my first really kind of on my own diving into it was reading probably Reni Eddo Lodge's book when that came out, and then really committing to it, you know, I think probably when Layla's book, Layla Sard's White Supremacy and Me, last year. So I remember being around when she did her challenge, but I didn't do it quite properly. I didn't go deep enough, right? And I feel like I did surface level external learning and got things cognitively. But when I did Layla's book, that's when I really started to focus inward. And also that coincided with doing therapy and things like that, which makes a big difference in being able to do the internal work. Because you can do external actions, you can take external actions without actually feeling it in the same way. So I feel like that was when I really started to commit to it. And then that's what made me sign up for Courageous Courage, which then just so happened to time with, you know, June last year. And then bought into your anti-racism course. Yeah.
Yeah. So you are somebody who is very active in your anti-racism. You embody it. It's a part of your life, I feel. I'm putting words in your mouth. It feels very much like it's coming from an embodied place from you. It's in your life. It's in your world. It's in your day to day. And so my question is, do you think that you would be embodying it in this way if you weren't married to a Black man and raising mixed Black children?
Mm. I've thought about the answer to this question before, actually, because I would like to think that I would be. I'd really like to think that, you know, if that was the case. If I'm being honest, I really don't know. Like, I don't know. It's of utmost importance. And it's also very painful to do the work sometimes in that way, because you know how much you can cause harm, right, to the people who you most care about. I'd like to think I would, because I do have lots of Black people outside of my family who I've always been surrounded by. Would I have ended up in a different environment if I hadn't, you know, got together with Michael at such a young age? I don't know. Like, yeah, I would like to think I would. And I can see that my wider family are more committed, and, you know, and there are other people in my life who do that same thing. And in the Instagram world that I'm in as well, lots of the people who I follow are doing that as well. The honest answer is I don't know, but I would love to think that I would. And I also think that it can't just be them, right? It can't just be my family, can't just be the driver. Although they are a big part of why I do it, it can't be the only thing. And I have Black boys, you know, I have Black mixed boys. My husband's Black, but also understand the nuance of Black women and Black trans people and other people outside of my family. It's not just for them, even though, of course, it makes it. I think the personal stuff gets really hard when it's your own family.
Yeah, it's the hardest. Thank you for answering that so honestly. It's something that I see. So, you know, there are many people who engage in anti-racism work, some of which are on my course or have done my course. And I say we as in other anti-racism activists, educators like Layla, who's spoken about this before. You can see when somebody who is racialized as white has only got it intellectually, and when they are embodying it. So when they've got it intellectually and when they become the work, it's like night and day. And so I see that happening sometimes. I'm like, yeah, you are holding me and my work on a pedestal, saying, oh, well, I've done Nobody's anti-racism course. And I'm looking at others thinking, you've got it intellectually, but you're not doing the work. It's surface level. Mm. So it becomes very, it's very obvious when people embody it and when they don't. So I guess my question to you is, how do you know when you are embodying the work rather than just getting it intellectually?
Mm. Oh, such a good question. I feel like one of the things is that you start to filter it through everything you know and what you really feel, instead of, I read this book and that told me this thing, right? You start to be able to filter in it through your own understanding. And then instead of actually tokenizing every person's opinion. Like, instead of looking at a black person and saying, oh, well, I've got to believe black people and I've got to believe that opinion, or I've got to believe that, you can start looking at content and ideas and concepts because you're able to feel into what feels right and what feels human and not, you know, and working towards change. And I feel like a real switch for me was when I was able to stop, we can't stop making judgments, or of course, like, you know, completely people judge, but starting to see someone's human, like their humanness, their humanity, and have compassion and see actually my feelings of, I can't believe that person's doing that, or, oh my goodness, white people, which I, you know, in the last years, I've got had so many times my husband's like, what's wrong with white people right now? You know, that has been a concept. So the idea of white people doing, you know, ridiculous things wasn't a new thing, but feeling it myself, I think, came when I really started listening to black women, honestly, like listening to black women and not shaming other people, because you realize actually, if you think about it on a timeline, this tiny knot is what I know, and this massive piece of string on the other side of the knot is what I don't know. Mm. And so you might be a little bit further along than somebody else, but understanding that you still have far to go, and we can all still make mistakes, and I think that starts to help you realize, oh, I'm feeling this on a different level. And and I think you can read all the books you want, but doing it in community with other people is a really different thing as well. To me, I feel like this work cannot be done on Instagram or in
Instagram. Gosh.
And that's not to say that you can't do it in a way. That's not to say you have to spend lots of money doing things, or you have to, read certain texts. That it's not that. It's doing it in community with real people, I think, mm-hmm. that makes a huge difference. And learning from the people who it most impacts as well.
Yeah. Learning from the people who it most impacts is a really important thing, because at the moment you're seeing, especially in the noise of social media, that people are losing their ability to use their common sense and also their discernment, and they're just taking opinions left, right and centre. It can be easy to see how people can get completely overwhelmed by the amount of noise that there is on social media. And when you get overwhelmed by the noise that there is on social media, you then get distracted from doing the actual work, which, as you say, it is communal. It's one of the, it is within your family. It is within your place of worship. It is within your local community. It is within schools. Like, though, when I say communal, it's those things. That's where we really have the most impact, because it's closest to us.
Yeah.
So I think, it can. Social media has a place. Like, I've met you via social media. I've met Leila Saad via social media, and incredible people doing the work. But I think if you solely rely on that for activism, then we're not really doing, we're on the surface. The surface, for sure.
And I think social media, it by its nature, is performative. Like, by its nature. And it can go on a deeper level. And like you say, I've met brilliant people in that way. But by its nature, Instagram itself, Facebook, all of these different platforms, they work on algorithm basis. They push the content that lands the most. And that polarizes people as well. Like, that's how... governments, that's how political parties can run campaigns, that because through our algorithms and Instagram feeds and the amount of data that we give people, I feel like social media is not the best place necessarily for discourse in a way that actually helps to move towards change. It can help, I think sometimes it helps you feel like you're making a difference, but actual in-person real life difference. And that's not to say, I think I want to be careful, because I know I can use ableist language sometimes, and I'm trying to get that out of my body, right? Get that out of my system. Yeah. And I want to be sure to know that, like, there are some people that where social media is a place for them to be in community with people. So I'm not saying that's not the case. And I think it's about finding those places where you can be in a brave space, not necessarily a safe space. There's no such thing, I think, online, but a courageous space, and show up and learn and listen.
Well, I think there are two... So yes, social media and all of the platforms are vast, but I guess when I'm talking about social media and where I see discourse being shut down, and it's just impossible to have any kind of dialogue on Twitter. It's impossible to have any meaningful dialogue Well, you're going to be restricted with the dialogue you can have on Instagram. Of course, when you're on an online community like Mighty Networks, I'm on Mighty Networks with a Buddhist community, actually, you can exchange with one another, you can start dialogue. And then, but it's, my point is, that isn't in isolation, that's not enough. It will never be enough. It's a way in, it's accessible, it's the way that we can connect with people who are different to ourselves, which I think is a real positive thing. But alone, it's not enough.
Yeah, it's the gateway, isn't it? It can be a good gateway to deeper dives.
For sure. So if you're happy to share, what has been some of the hardest lessons for you in this anti-racism journey?
Okay, so I guess one of the hardest lessons is, for me, I feel like internal stuff has actually been easier sometimes, because actually I feel like outwardly I'm sometimes not very brave. I don't like what's the word? Not discomfort, but when I can feel tension feels, or angry voices, and I'm not assigning those angry voices to any individual people. But when I feel a sense of disagreement, that makes me feel really uncomfortable, right? So I've go bright red, you know, when I would have to get up in front of people and speak, I would go bright red, and I can feel myself, if I'm getting angry, I have to almost clamp my jaw shut as if I'm about to say something I'm going to regret. And so I feel like actually one of the biggest things for me has been about taking action that feels uncomfortable in terms of speaking to other people who maybe don't want to hear it, who are maybe feeling resistant, who have grown up with the let's not talk about it, because if we talk about it then it's an issue. That to me has felt more uncomfortable than actually learning that stuff myself sometimes, because I can feel it in my body. Like I can feel my body feeling sick, and oh my goodness, I've got to have a meeting with the school or whatever it might be. And actually that was why I joined Courageous Courage, because I was like, that's what I need. I need some courageousness to be able to have, to just go out and have those conversations and take action. Cause it's not just about listening and learning. It is actually about taking actions that can help as well. So I think it's been the hardest lesson for me.
And it's not shying away from the fact that you're like, our bodies are communicating with us. So if there is that bigger physiological response going on, like that to me, right, that's an invitation to interrogate. Like, what's that about? Like, why is that disproportionate? Have I experienced that before? Okay, if I've experienced that before, when did I experience that? Is there some old stuff there that needs some, I need some support with? Is this new? Is this present? So for me, there's so much information that our bodies give us. And we try and bypass it or shut it down or ignore it. And I'm like, just be with it. Like, your body is having a physiological response for a reason, either because it's gone into a flight fight mode and it literally thinks you're under attack when you're not, and therefore, okay, some tools to help you manage that, or there's something else. So for me, it's like, okay, what is happening here? And rather than feeling panicked by it, it's learning to be with it, then find what the lessons are, and then, you know, take meaningful action. What's been one of your biggest aha moments from doing the course particularly?
Okay, so in the course there's a section on Black women and white women, right, and the relationships.
Yes.
That section in the course, Nova, I felt that one in my soul, right? And I feel like I'd understood lots before that, but then the thing that really got me in there was that you talking about, you're like, it's not neutral. An exchange between Black and white women is not neutral due to history. It doesn't matter what your history with that person is necessarily. It's the history of relationships between Black and white women. Yeah. And that section in your course really takes you through like the history there. And I read a book, I can't remember the name. We Were Her Property.
It's on the reading list. Yeah.
Oh my goodness. And that book I felt in my bones. That is a tricky listen, but Audible. But I feel like that, and there's points in that book that actually talk to like that you can hear and you're like, oh my goodness, that's like how it is currently. Like there is this, they're talking about slavery years ago and the legacy that has lasted. And even in the UK, we think it doesn't have the same effect, but where do you think the people who moved over to the US came from? there's so much there that the relationship's there. It doesn't matter. There is always that history there, and yes, the context of it is really important. And knowing, you know, how to see people's humanity and actually really listen to what people need from you. Mm. That bit in the course really stood out to me.
Was it sobering for you? I think at the end of that one, I ask students to think about what Black women in their life they owe a meaningful apology to.
Yes.
I think I do that in the course. I definitely do that in my book.
So I think when I did this, I had already gone through the process of, oh, I owe a few apologies. So when I got there, I was like, oh my goodness, yeah, okay, I'm glad I've done that now. but that definitely, that definitely happened. And I have had people say things to me, and I felt tokenized here, and I've had to offer an apology. And I'm glad I had the tools to be able to do that and not, oh no, I didn't mean anything by it, because that's not helpful, right?
Well, it's also...
It is really,
It's not helpful, but it's also not an apology, because
it's also not an apology.
More interested about our perception than we are, you know, taking responsibility for the harm caused, regardless of our intent. Then it's not really. Then don't apologize. I mean, this part of the course has also formed my favorite chapter in the book. I mean, it takes on a different, totally different format in the book, but it's probably going to be the hardest read for women who are racialized as white. And I hope that it will probably be a really empowering read for the people who read the book who are Black or brown. But it's the foundation of why some cross-racial relationships with white women and Black women are a challenge for so many. And I think you go.
I think and that's the thing. I think as white women, I'll speak for myself. I think it's growing up, I've been like, oh, why doesn't so-and-so like me? Or, you know, you take the problem away from you. And I think that's a general thing we often, like with other things, we can say, oh, that's not a me thing. That's somebody else just has their issue. But actually, the more and more you look into it, there's an understanding there. You can work out why that is. And you can work out why Black women can be wary of white women because of what we've enabled or allowed or perpetuated ourselves. And I'm looking forward to reading that chapter. That shit.
Oh, I can't wait. But you know, it's a painful history. I'm doing some work with a trauma therapist called Resma Medicum. On his social media, we were talking about there was a recent policewoman in the United States who opened fire and killed a Black man, and said that she thought she'd pulled out her taser. And so we were talking about, and in his book, My Grandmother's Hands, he talks about the police and actually this fear response in white people and how dangerous that is when the body is a police in the police force. And if you've got automatic fear response or automatic suspicion when you see somebody who is Black and you're instinctively reaching for your gun, like the impact of that, we all see it. And so we were discussing that on social media, and I was talking about that book again. Like, people really need to read They Were Her Property. And I think he was as well. And I said, people need to understand the role that white women have played and continue in upholding both patriarchy and white supremacy. And some of that is conscious and some of it is not, but it is historical. And the reason why it's so challenging for some people, because I got trolled the other day. I spoke about that around that time on a colleague's feed and ended up getting a whole load of trolling and being called racist piece of shit. And I'm racist to white women. And this was from other white women. I'm like, they don't even realize the irony of the violence and the racism that they are inflicting because they don't want to hear. But it's because we've painted historically for patriarchy to exist. White women have always been painted as these sort of damsels in distresses that needed rescuing from white men. But actually, when we really look at history and the violence that went on from white women to black bodies, it's like we need to know for firstly, and we need to confront this, and we need to interrogate how it's still manifesting today. Otherwise, we just won't move forward.
Yeah, there's a line in that book about how a young girl and her slave, the black woman slave, and the relationship between them. And there were two really points that the author made about, you know, and one of them was that it didn't matter what their relationship was up until that point. It didn't matter that this woman had looked after her since birth, that in that moment there was no, the societal imbalance still came into play in their relationship. And I was like, that's so true today. It doesn't matter what doesn't matter what your friendship or your relationship is before, if our society props up that imbalance, and the power there is weighted for some, for white women to be able to say anything, like to be able to say something,
And also automatically be believed
and automatically be trusted that is
I know. Yeah. It's big work, and that's what I was saying to someone who was having a discourse with on social media has its uses, but I was having a discourse with on social media, and they're like, this is really hard. And I'm like, yeah, it is hard, but it's our history. Like, it's all of ours. Like, this isn't anyone pointing blame. Like, we need to look at it and confront it and interrogate it to understand why there continues to be imbalance and dysfunction and anti-blackness today, and people have to be willing to go there, and not many are, Amanda, because as you know, it's not an easy thing to confront.
It is. I think that's where I'm sure that like a lot of the time, like, it's hard to commit to this work. Sure, like, if I really commit, you know, I know there's some stuff there that I'm not sure I want to learn. So I'm not sure I want to hear about that, because that's going to tell me some stuff about myself I don't want to know. And it can be really difficult, because then you're like, oh, now I've got to apologize to this person, or now I'm actually, you know, you cannot then stop seeing it when you really commit to it. It's, you realize how much it's tied up in patriarchy and capitalism, and how capitalism fuels it all. And
always has. And that's what I say, it's like you can't unsee it. It's like seeing the world with more clarity, or seeing the world with a brand new pair of glasses, and you just got this clarity, and you can't go back. Well, you can go back, but it probably means that you're going to be living a life that is not in integrity. And for some people, that's very confronting. We saw that last year with sort of the rise in interest in anti-racism as a result of, you know, so many deaths on black bodies, and this momentum, and then slowly it dissipating, and I'm like, yeah, they've got to a point where they've realized what is required beyond putting a black square on Instagram and beyond sharing a few posts from black women, beyond reading the first few pages of Layla's Me and White Supremacy, and then, you know, opting out of the book club, like joining an accountability group and then leaving the group. Like, it's not easy work. And that's why I say it's not for the faint-hearted. So,
and I think that's why it's so important, like, you really center, like, you know, self-care, and then you can go back into this cycle. Like, you have to look after yourself, and you have to then rededicate, recommit to it, and there's a cycle. Like, you can't. And actually, I realized, like, for myself, that actually before, if I wasn't looking after myself, you would burn out, and then you become apathetic. You're like, I can't possibly do any more of this. And then you actually just fall back into doing nothing, and that's not a sustainable cycle. And so I love how you center that. And actually, by not centering my own self-care in that, that's what's that? I'm better than everyone else. I don't need self-care. That's just centering myself again to say that I can do this work without actually, you know, taking time, because it does. It is big work.
There's also an element to it that dehumanizes it. If you go in with the idea that I don't need to take care of myself, I can just do this, I'm not phased. And there's an element of that that makes you a little bit less human. And like the whole point in anti-racism is to rehumanize us, because the whole system that we have operated in and continue to operate in has come from the bedrock of dehumanization. So for me, the opposite of that is seeing black people in their humanity, and also, you know, rehumanizing yourself as well. Because when you cut off the ability to empathize with a group of people, that also makes you less human. So there's so many layers around, well, how are we going to do this work in a sustainable way where we look after ourselves? How are we going to serve others? How are we going to serve a cause that is greater than us if we're not taking basic care of ourselves on a regular basis? Because it can be really difficult, and it's so important to re-resource, and also helps with our resilience to do that. And also, like, why wouldn't you want to take care of yourself? Like, this is the only body that you have.
Oh, I love the work you do. And you give me so much hope. You do. Like, I think that's something that I look at, because I think there's a lot of people who are like, oh, what's the point? I can't see anything changing. I can't see. But I do now. I see now that I have committed and I've worked out who are my people to circle back to, what are my things that I can do? And you can see the ripple effect it has. And also just knowing that if you, Nova, didn't see that things could change, you wouldn't be doing this work. Like, that gives me hope as well. And seeing you showing up for humans and for black folks and centering those who are the most marginalized, that gives me hope all the time and helps me recommit to this work.
Thank you. And I do see that's, you know, I often work with companies who want me to come in and solve institutionalized racism in their organization with a 3-hour workshop for senior managers. I'm like, it's not realistic. Like, come off it. Like, I cannot unlearn your racism for you. Like, that, your racism is yours. Like, you have to be committed to interrogating it first. Well, accepting that it's there first, then interrogating it, then unlearning it, and then, you know, relearning language, knowledge, history, whatever it is, so that you can bring about change within your communities. And I can go and deliver a workshop, but we've all been to workshops, or we've all done things that we felt really pumped up about and then done absolutely nothing about it afterwards. You know, most of us has done, got really energized to do some kind of well-being commitment. I'm not a gym user, but I'll use it because it's in my mind. But going to the gym, we can all go to the gym and take some nice selfies and post them on social media. So yeah, great. But we're not going to actually improve our well-being or our fitness goals if we don't actively do something at the gym or within our diet or whatever it is to help us improve our well-being. Like, I am notoriously iron deficient, and so I have to take great care with my iron intake, because if I don't, it impacts everything, including my cognitive ability. And I can't whinge and complain about the fact that I've got brain fog and I'm struggling with memory and concentration, when I know that the cause of that is because I've not been consistently taking my iron. So I can take my iron every now and then, but it won't make a change if I don't continuously and consistently be intentional with what I'm putting in my body. And that's the same for anti-racism. Like, we can do bits and bobs, but we have to be intentional and consistent with it for there to be any kind of change.
What a good analogy. You can turn up to the gym, but if you don't actually use the exercise machine, then you're not going to feel like your heart rate's improved.
Whatever your goal is, it's not going to be achieved.
It's not going to be achieved
by just being there.
And I think that's like, you can turn up to workshops even. And that's what the difference is, because you asked before about the difference between cognitively and getting it in your body, right? And feeling it in your body, embodying it. And I think that's where it feels really different, because you can read, like I say, you can read all the things, but if you don't be like, oh, why did that make me feel a bit like this? And that's one of the things I do all the time now. If I'm reading a book, so if I listen to audiobooks, and I have on my desktop, I have like a folder, anti-racism stuff, notes, and I put the title of the book. And as I'm going, I just type questions to like think on later or stuff that comes up. and then pop a question in there and be like, why did that make me feel that way? Or what did that tell me about myself? What is that telling me about what, like the amount of things that I've gone, oh my goodness, I just remembered this thing I did and that was really inappropriate. And now I'm like, feel really cringe. But actually it helps you to work out, why am I feeling like this? And you can learn from your past mistakes. And
and that
feels different than just listening to or reading a book. It feels different to actually
you've just demonstrated what it means to be active within your anti-racism and to pay attention. Like this is a really important bit that I drive through. Pay attention to the messages that your body is sending you. Like don't stop. We need to stop disconnecting and just pay attention. There is so much information and knowledge we can get by, okay, if something happens, I use the words benign and malignant to differentiate when something's happened. And if something happens and I'm benign, there's no reaction to it, there's nothing there for me to interrogate. Unless it's unusual that there's no reaction. But if something happens and I'm really feeling like something in my stomach's in a knot, or I've suddenly gone hot, or my hands have started sweating, or my heart started beating, or my intonation patterns have gone up, like, whoa, there's a shift. There's something. What is that? Like, use that as an invitation. And what you've just demonstrated is that you've learned that as a practice now, and you're continually doing it. And that is part of, particularly with the individual journey, of being actively anti-racist. It's not always shouting and telling other people. It's not shouting, but it's not telling other people what to do. It's like, okay, what's going on for me right now?
I think even the ripple effect of that can make a difference, because just sharing what you're learning, or I've found that to be powerful, because I think people don't want to be told what to do. Well, I don't know for sure. I say this as a type 3 Enneagram, and I hate being told what to do. I feel shame intensely. I don't like to be wrong or not know stuff. I know this about myself. But I think, like, we don't want to feel like, oh, we didn't know that. Or, you know, for those of us who are at the stage probably listening to your podcast, we don't want to feel like, oh, I didn't know that thing. And so I think, like, that can be, or the people who we're talking to maybe, is that just sharing, oh, this is where I'm at, or what made you, you know, and you always talk about getting curious, is that it's like being curious about yourself as well. You talk about being curious in general, right? When you're having conversations with people.
Yeah.
But being curious about what is going on here with me. And I think just that showing that curiousness to other people helps them to get curious themselves as well. Doesn't mean you're not saying, hey, that was totally not okay for you to say that, or, you know, approaching the school or whatever it is, taking action that is different to, you know, conversing with your friends and family or people you're close to.
Yeah. And I think that's another thing that comes with confidence that I think you will get as the more you do, you know, you've done Layla's book, you are in community with, on that online community with Check Your Privilege. You have done my course. You are connected with people who have also done my course, and you have an accountability group. You are also within one of my online communities. So there's all these ways that help you continue to have confidence. And I think that also has an impact on how you approach the school, or how you approach a relationship, or
and I feel it's with the kids, of course. It's like, it feels, there's something about, as soon as it's your kids, it feels really, it feels like the stakes are high. That's what, like, that for me is a real, like, whew, I don't want to, you know, cause more problems, or, you know, and that feels, so I've recognized that in myself. But yeah, I find that one interesting, because you're aware of, I think once you become aware of, oh, I can intentionally cause harm, and you can commit to making sure you don't do that, you know. But it is, you know, constantly, and seeing it, you know, in the way your children, like, ask questions of you, and yeah, there's a lot to learn, and yeah.
There's a lot to learn and unlearn, and just something I want to pick up on. I hear you in saying there's a commitment to not causing harm, but actually what's more important to me is like you're on this journey, you're going to.
Yeah.
You can commit to caring mm-hmm. about not causing harm, and knowing that when you do, okay, this is what I need to do to atone and repair that. It's not, there is a culture that I see with anti-racism about it being perfection. Well, what shall I do? What shall I say? Give me all the tools. And then this real fear about actually engaging with one another as human beings. And that also stops us from being having human experience. And it's not about not ever causing harm again. Of course, mm. When we're more aware and when we are more intentional, that reduces, the risk of causing harm reduces, but also we live in a racist society and we have white supremacist programming within every single system and human community, particularly in the West. So it's going to crop up sometimes, yeah. and we're not always going to see it. We're going to have hidden spots. And so it's important for me to say that what's more important is that when we do cause harm again, even though we know better, that there is that repair and atonement, which is the component that is often so missing.
I honestly think one of the biggest things was realizing, I'm not always going to get this right, and that's okay.
Yeah.
Because I'm going to learn from that when I get it wrong. And I'm going to learn from that, and then I'm going to keep going. And I think genuinely that's one of the biggest drivers in me actually being able to keep doing it, because without that, and also I've struggled with perfectionism my whole life. And it's interesting, like there's when I thought of someone in the Check Your Privilege group shared about perfectionism being like a construct of white privilege, like of white supremacy. And, you know, it's us having to always be perfect at that and seeing things in the binary of this is good and this is bad. And actually just accepting, I'm going to make a mistake sometimes. That's okay. I'm going to try anyway. I'm not going to not care about causing harm, but it's better to keep going. That doesn't mean you stop. And that's why it's both, right? It's not either or. It's not I'm going to learn or I'm going to take action. It's do both, that you can do both of these things. And that is the biggest.
That's the most important.
I had to apologize to someone just recently. Like I was like, you know what? I just realized I didn't notice the nuance here. And I'm really sorry, because I realized that my place there, that might not have been the right thing to say to you. And I think like that, that's been a hard lesson. But it actually feels so much easier just accepting I'm inevitably going to cause harm because I've had 30 years of this stuff, right? I've had 30 years of...
And it's more than 30 years. It's what we carry historically. It's what we carry historically. So it's more than that. It's what is in our family. It's what's familial. So, the ego and anti-racism do not, like, get on at all.
Such a massive ego, seriously. No,
so when you, if you don't mind sharing, so when you recently, you know, took accountability for whatever that situation was, did that person appreciate that, your acknowledgement of that?
Yeah, they did say, you know what, I didn't take it like that, but I do appreciate the apology, which to mm-hmm. me said that even if they didn't, well, they might have felt they had to say that. I don't know, because I don't know this person very well. It's not that kind of relationship, but I appreciate the apology. The fact that they said that they appreciated it made me think that even if it wasn't directly hurtful now, it may have been, or it may have been something that had happened in the past, or, you know. And so I think, yeah, and I think apologies are a tricky one, because sometimes they can just make you feel better, and it's not about that. It's about actually wanting to make sure that person is okay, right? So I thought about it a lot, but I think she was glad that I had done that. And it told her that I was open to her sharing with me if that had been a problem. So
yeah, for sure. It's adulting, really.
I think it's really, like, I think lots of us don't learn this kind of stuff, right? Growing up. So it helps in just daily life and conversations. And that can't be our, you know, anti-racism isn't about self-improvement work. It can't be the goal, but it's a side effect of doing it, is that I feel like it just helps you be a better human, because you start to see people as humans. Like,
I mean, that's certainly how I teach it. That's the goal. Like, you can't do this work and not be transformed.
Yeah.
You can't, let me rephrase that. You can't do this work properly. You cannot embody this work without being transformed by it. So something you and I have spoken about before is something you have started to observe, raising mixed black boys with mixed textured hair, is the fetishization of their hair in curly hair communities online. How do you navigate that space as a white woman who's also advocating for your boys to what sounds like a community of other parents who are not in anti-racism work?
Yeah, so I think it's a really tricky one because it's Facebook groups, and we spoke about social media before. Facebook groups are really tricky because you can let people in. Admins can easily block people. You know, people can cause a lot of havoc before deciding to leave the group as well. There's a lot of, there's a lot of different things. And it's interesting because you can go into a group. So I actually, for context, I joined curly hair groups a few years back when I was, you know, learning how to look after the boys' hair. And then I actually left them because there was so much, some just blatant racism and then a lot of colorism and texturism that I didn't know yet how to respond to people without just being judgy, without being like, I can't believe you're saying that about your kid's hair. Or, you know, even though I had maybe just learned, oh, I shouldn't say that. So I left and I came back recently to join some for a product recommendation. And based on that, I ended up, I don't know why I went down this rabbit hole, Nova, but I ended up joining a couple of these, you know, these different groups. And it's interesting to see the difference because you can see that some people, you can tell if it's not spoken about because people, any conversations on race or racism in some of the groups are just shut down as, no, we just talk about hair here, as if we just talk about hair and not the person is attached to, right? And it's like, which is, yeah. And then, so any talk of that kind of thing is often just shut down. And then in other groups, there's some groups that are run by Black and other people of colour, admins, and some of those groups are brilliant, and I've learned so much from being in those groups. But you can also observe the fetishization when there are these beautiful curls compared to a more type 4 hair texture. And yeah, it's interesting to see, and it's also, I feel like it's hard to navigate sometimes in terms of knowing that actually some people don't want to hear something they don't want to hear sometimes, especially if they're like, oh no, that means I'm saying something horrible to my child or whatever it is. So yeah, I can observe that a lot. And I do, if I'm honest, I don't always know how to navigate it.
What makes it feel hard?
Because I know that if the end goal is that you want the child who is involved, because adults and they, you know, there's that. But if the child involved is, if a white parent is talking about their mixed black child in a way that's negative or something like that, what you want is ideally for them to not talk to their child like that anymore. But they really have to commit to their own anti-racism work to be able to see all the things there. So I find myself, you talked about this before briefly, I find myself like, I want to help in a way that helps them to maybe just take that education further without getting a thread shut down, for example, right? So help take that education further and give some resources for like, hey, here's some places like to learn more about. This is where I've learned more about this. Or I used to talk about my kids' hair like that and I've learned I shouldn't say that. Here's where I would go. But it feels like this weird balancing act on social media because I also, you're conscious to not talk over Black women's voices as well. Yeah, it's a constant. I do feel like it's sometimes a constant weighing up, and one of the groups I'm not in anymore. It's because it feels like maybe sometimes your energy is best in a different place that is not in a Facebook group. Mm. But I have observed a lot of that. Yeah.
So the fetishization is around. So for type 4 hair, 4C is like mine, very tight coils. Traditionally, well, more traditionally seen as afro. Textured hair, thick, and you hear language that's often used with hair like mine, and my hair is natural now, it's not always been like this. I have a hair straightener in it to I have, you know, I wear lots of extensions, it's, you know, I do lots of things with my hair. But part of the reason why my hair, I never had my hair in its natural state, the way that it grows out of my head most naturally is because there's a perception that straight hair and Eurocentric hair is better. Mm-hmm. It is more professional. So I remember nights and evenings when my mum would use this hot comb and she'd be straightening my hair. I had thick, thick hair. I wonder if I can find an image and share it, but really thick, long, beautiful, bushy hair. But the language was it's hard, it's tough, it's unmanageable. And so then you think that there is something inherently wrong with your hair. And there's no judgment with my mum. She was doing what she thought was best and what had been role modeled for her, and also what she had experienced. Like, you get policed and discriminated against in this country when your hair deviates from something that's more Eurocentric. And so, you know, you see that filtering out. A friend of mine is a new mother and to a mixed black girl, and her hair has started to... You're starting to see what her hair is going to be like. It's gone past the sort of the baby fine hair stage, and you can see the texture a bit more. And she said, oh God, oh no, it's getting wild. And so now I feel it's important for me to start inviting her in. Mm. So that her little girl doesn't end up thinking there is something inherently wrong with her hair, how it is in its natural state. And no, it's not wild. It's different. It's just different to what has been accustomed to being the norm. But language around hair and how that can lead to self-hate is so important, that there is a consciousness with the words that we're using to describe children who've got Afro-textured hair or mixed-textured hair.
I can see the difference between my two children as well, because the younger one has... And again, I'm trying not to use loaded language, because it is so, like, the words we use to describe it, I don't want them to start taking those on themselves, right? So he has got a kind of a looser curl pattern. It takes much less time to look after it, to manage it in the bath when we brush it through with a load of conditioner. But it's... in comparison to the older one, his takes like four times as long, needs some additional deep conditioning treatments. He wears it out in a huge afro. He's super proud of his huge afro, and he picks it out with his afro comb, and he absolutely loves it. But he does get teased for his hair, and you know, and people want to touch it, and he's perfectly happy to tell people don't touch it. He tells me if I'm absentmindedly go and pick something out of his hair, he's like, excuse me, you're not allowed to touch my hair, mum. That's you get three chances. That's his rule to get it wrong. And I think there's a certain amount, you like autonomy for your child, and then also like, hey, don't touch my kid's hair. You know, there's a balance there. But I can see the difference there in the way they're treated. And I'm also really trying to be conscious of my language, because I know there was definitely a time when I called Zach's hair, oh, but it's wild. But all that meant I didn't know how to look after it. Yeah. That meant I actually haven't. I haven't worked out how to do this. And actually, when I learned, someone, a black woman in one of these groups said that, and she said, "It's Afro hair isn't hard to look after. You just don't know how to look after it."
Yeah.
There's a really big difference.
Yeah.
So I'm really conscious to not say to them, oh my goodness, Zach, your hair takes so much longer. Even though he will say that himself, I'm like, that's okay. We're going to find a way to manage it. You know, we're going to find a way to look after it, and to not use that language, because I think it could really easily, I could see how they could be compared. And so I'm really glad I have that knowledge, because I can feel myself being careful with my language on purpose. But if you didn't know better, you would, like, you would just...
Yeah, because what, of course, when people are saying, you know, flippantly without understanding or having the historical backing, they're saying these things based on the assumption that what we should all aspire to, or what is normal, is silky, straight, sleek, Eurocentric hair. And our hair is so different. And it's like, why are we only, you know, from hair discrimination cases right through to, you know, how hard it is to find hairdressers who are competent at working with Afro-textured and mixed textured hair. It's like, why are we not... I can't remember the stat now, but it's been predicted that by a certain point in the not so distant future, the main ethnicity group will be mixed. We are blending. We are mixing with one another. So why is it that we still don't know how to? Why is it that in terms of hairdressing schools, there are still so many hairdressers who are not competent or skilled or training to learn how to work with mixed and Afro-textured hair? I found it profound, because we're not aliens. Our hair texture is different to what has been predicated as the standard. But, you know, put us in another country, our hair texture is the norm. So that is, I mean, I am now learning how to look after my hair, because for so long I've not had my hair in its natural state. So now it's a learning. I am learning what products I now need to use in it. I am learning for the first time as a grown adult that the best way to look after my hair in terms of combing it so that there isn't the trauma that's associated it with trying to comb it in a way that it's not designed for, is to do it when it's wet. But I didn't learn that when I was growing up. Like, so there's so much stuff there, and it's definitely a bigger conversation, but it's really interesting to me that you're already being mindful of language, but just observing how your boys are treated differently because of their hair texture.
And I can see it's like based on, you know, it should be based on health, right? Like the health of the hair, not the style that it's in. I think it comes down to what we see as well as the markers, right? Those European beauty standards, we see in the adverts, the silky smooth hair, and that seems to be the texture that we should be desiring. And I can see the difference in my younger and older child having that different hair texture. One's looks more typically what would you think of as healthy and reflects the light, and the other's doesn't. That's not his hair texture. That's just not the way it comes naturally out of his head. And actually I've had, my husband's really keen on making sure that they know it doesn't matter if their hair wakes up like that. He's like, they don't need to have their hair perfectly combed and brushed to go out the house. Like, they are allowed to have their hair natural, to have a, I'm not going to spend loads of time doing my hair today, and allowed to go out like that. Mm. And I think there's also, it can swing to the other side of wanting their hair to look perfect all the time, because of course we need to look after their hair. But it can also swing to the other side where it couldn't possibly, we don't want it to possibly look a bit unkempt or, you know, uncared for, because then we're not doing a good enough job. And I think it can really, you know, nuance and balance, as with everything. But there is, you know, boys should be able to be boys and go out with their hair in its natural state. And yeah.
And I think that, again, that's another negative stereotype that has been loaded down, that our hair, even if it is cared for, is unkept, which is it's another racist stereotype. It's not true. But equally, you know, if somebody white wants to go out to and play in the park and they've got a messy bun, then why can't we have the alternative? But there is this, again, this pressure to be perfect and kept so that we don't feed into this racist stereotype. And I actually think, yeah, absolutely, there is an educational piece that is lacking and missing around how to care for our hair. But equally, if we're trying to make it look pristine and perfect all the time, then who are we doing that for?
I said the phrase, boys should be boys, but I hate that phrase and I don't know why I said it. You know, they should be able to go out there with their sticks and their helmets on and their, you know, capes and their costumes and not have to worry about what everyone thinks of them, even though, of course, they do. But I love that we can create that for them and give them the space to be themselves.
Yeah. Thank you for going there with me. I appreciate it. I could talk to you forever, Amanda. I recorded a new version of my anti-racism course over Christmas, well, just before Christmas last in 2020, and Amanda was kind enough to provide support, so we got to meet in real life, all masked up, support for the production team. And Amanda gave me a card, and I didn't read it until I got home. Let me just give some context. It was at the end of a really very difficult year, pandemic, racial injustice, extraordinary rise in interest and pressure to deliver on anti-racism, my own trauma being triggered, and delivering a book on anti-racism. So I was right at the tip of burnout. And I was pushing through to get this stuff filmed because I knew if I didn't get it filmed at that point of the year, it was never going to happen. It was really important for me that content was updated. Probably didn't need all that detail, but here we are. And I just remember I was really depleted. So I didn't read the card for a few days after, until a few days after I got home. And I wish I could, I wish it was with me now. It's downstairs, but hey ho. And it said words to the effect, you might remember, Amanda, but words to the effect of how my work, the work, how I teach it has taught you so much about love. There was something about love. And I would really love to hear more about you, about where, what that means and where that came from. Because it was, I'd never had anyone speak to me about my anti-racism work in that way before.
I hope that was a positive.
It was.
Positive thing.
I cried. I just, it was just so beautiful and it was wonderful.
I think I want to be like cautious in saying that I think like that this work can come out from Black educators. I think white, it's different, obviously. And I think, you know, white people, we need to understand our role and the way we approach doing the work, and it's very different. And so I want to make sure that like it's not about one person's way being better or another, but the way in which you do your work, I feel like I can see your love for humans and your love for people and for Black folks and uplifting people who have been oppressed for generations, for lifetimes. You know, I can see that work you do and I feel like there's this love coming through it. And that's not to say that other people can't do work from a place, from a totally different emotion, to a totally different place, and it have an impact, because I think that it does. And there's all different ways that impact can be had in that way from different emotions. It's not just one. But your way of doing that, that comes, I grew up as a Christian, you know, and I came from that background of doing things in a way that, of really loving people. And I feel that keenly in your work, in the way that you communicate with people. And I can also see it that, I can also see that for people who are struggling to see, you know, I think what you were saying on about, you know, social media, is that it can sometimes feel like that doesn't come through. And there, I see often white people in the comments, like I say, I'm not talking about Black women or Black people here sharing their anger. That's a totally different thing. And that's all valid and should be listened to. I'm talking about white people coming back thinking they know more and coming back in a way that is really harsh to other people who are learning, who are also on the journey. And I feel like you encourage us to dive into like, this is about you. This is your work to undo. But you do it from a place of loving humans. Like you do it from a place of loving humankind. And yeah, and you are a real example of love. And I think that comes through really strongly in your work. And it's an approach that really resonated with me. It's an approach that after seeing lots of white people specifically, white appearing people, I will say specifically, speaking very harshly to other people who are learning. And I think you mentioned this before, we were talking about this before, is that it's like, I think I've seen a lot of people appropriating language that was not for them. It's like, that's not your anger to feel in the same way. So I don't judge anyone who's sharing their trauma or their and it's not necessarily anger. Sometimes it's not anger. Sometimes it might be, but who's sharing in a way that is maybe in a tone that does not feel as acceptable to us, right? That does not feel, because maybe it's not speaking to us in the way that we like. But in terms of you showing me how I can communicate with others, I feel like having love and also wanting change for that person who's in that situation right now, who is feeling alone or like that people don't care. And that, I think, is really strong and comes through, and that really attracted me to your work.
Thank you. It's, I don't know any other way. I don't know any other way. So thank you.
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
No, it's just, you know, it's human. I don't shy away from what comes up for me in the moment. It's human. But yeah, that's the work. And I think where you like, I couldn't do this work if it wasn't for, like, I'm doing it for our liberation. When I say our in this particular circumstance, Black people, and I'm also doing it for humanity. Like, it's like you can't, everyone is linked. And I think if we haven't learned that from being in a global pandemic, that we're all intrinsically linked in some way, then we've been asleep. But I don't know any other way to do this. I wouldn't be able to do this work if it wasn't in that way, because I would just be very unwell. I would be very unwell. And it makes the most sense to me in my body. It makes the most sense to me. So thank you very much. Amanda, it's been incredible to share this corner of the internet with you today. Thank you so much for joining me.
You're welcome.
if people want to connect with you online, where can they find you?
Well, Nova, I'm trying to break my phone addiction, but people can find me on Instagram. It's amanda.apiaj. On Instagram. That's probably the best place to find me.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Wow. I was not expecting the episode to end in that way. But it was human and it felt honest to end that way. And I hope that you have enjoyed and learned from the episode. And if you're in a white body and you're curious about doing anti-racism work and leaning into discover it or embody it in a way that Amanda speaks about, then come on over and join us on Becoming Anti-Racist with Nova Reed, or, you know, find a path that speaks to you. But yeah, the work really does work when you do the work. So as ever, if this episode has resonated with you, I would love it if you would leave a review on your favorite podcast host. I appreciate you spending time with us today. If you do want to connect with Amanda, you may or may not find her lurking over on Instagram, but her Instagram bio also leads to other ways to find out about her work and her world. So it is amanda.appiaj, that's appiaGYEI. And as ever, let me know what you think. I'll be lurking, as I always am, over at Nova Reed Official on Instagram. Until then, see you next time.